Okay. So I'm going to be lecturing, talking, sharing some thoughts tonight on the topic of Sabbath. My title is Finding Sabbath Rest in a World That Never Stops. One of the wonderful things about working at Liberty is that we have total freedom to choose what we talk about for these Friday night lectures. People often ask us how we come up with the lecture topics and how we come up with the lecture schedule. And there's kind of three ways we pick lecture topics. The primary one is our students that come to Liberty. We pay attention to the things that they're talking about and asking questions about and bringing up. We also pay attention to what's happening kind of in the wider world, culture, and church. And then kind of the last way we pick lecture topics is just things that we are personally interested in on an individual basis. And this topic tonight falls in that last category. I actually don't hear many people in the church at large talking about Sabbath or taking the Sabbath commandment seriously. You guys might be in faith communities that do that. I haven't been part of that much. And it's also not a topic that for me has come up at Liberty. I've been at Liberty almost 7 years, and I don't think I've ever had a student bring up the topic of Sabbath in a discussion or in a tutorial. So this lecture is very much driven tonight by my own interest and need. Essentially, I'm tired. I'm really tired. And I'm not tired because of lack of sleep. I get plenty of sleep. But I'm just tired from life. And I'm assuming that some of you guys, if you came out to Liberty on a Friday night after a long week of school and work to hear about Sabbath, that you might be tired as well and looking for some life to put in that part of your life. In some ways, the seeds of my interest in this topic probably came from some thoughts I've had over the last couple of years regarding my own personal struggle with time. I'm one of those people that feels like I never have enough time to do what I need to do or what I want to do. But at the same time, I've always been really good at procrastinating and wasting time. I've been like great at that from my early days. I'm a bit neurotic about always wearing a watch. I kind of always know what time it is. I feel like I'm forever watching the clock and racing the clock. That's for legitimate things, like getting to meetings and appointments and stuff on time, but kind of also for stupid things. I decide in my head how long it should take me to complete tasks or projects, and then I get super frustrated when that doesn't turn out like I think it will. I seem to be really bad at gauging how long it takes to do things. And I'm one of those people whose to-do list is never done. It's never done. In any given day, I feel like I accomplished maybe 20% of what I thought I would at the beginning of the day and what I think I should be able to get done in a day. I'm always multitasking, but I'm actually really bad at that. I think most of us actually are really bad at multitasking. I'm really bad at it, but I try. And I go to bed most nights with kind of an unfinished to-do list in my head, a sense of what I have not done. I don't know if any of you can relate to this, but it's a pretty exhausting way to live, feeling like you're just never done. This is just sort of an analogy here, but I have an aging laptop computer, and I don't know if you guys have seen this with a computer or not, but sometimes my computer, when I'm like not touching it or doing anything with it, the fan will kick on. Like I can hear the fan whirring and working really hard. And I always think like, what's wrong? You're okay. I'm not even asking it to do anything, but the fan starts spinning and it, you know, and sometimes I feel like the computer that like, I feel like the fan, whatever that is within me, is just always whirring and working really hard, even when I'm not doing anything, even when nothing's expected of me, even when I'm not supposed to be somewhere. And that's just me. So some of you may not relate to that at all, but that's me. And I just wanted to put that out there as a bit of a place of kind of where I'm coming from and what my interest is in this topic. I find that I don't really know how to rest aside from sleeping, I sleep well, but aside from being totally passed out asleep, I don't really know how to be awake and rest or do restful things. I tend to go, and then crash. Like I'll go, and then collapse on the couch and watch a couple episodes of something on Netflix. Like there's a big gap. It's like I'm either at 100% or I'm at like 15% and not a whole lot in the middle. There's nothing wrong with watching Netflix, obviously, but that's just a pattern I've found myself in recently. And I feel like this way of operating is just starting to catch up with me. I've been adulting this way for close to 20 years now, and I'm like, I'm tired. This isn't working. About a year ago, I heard several different people talking about the book The Rest of God by Mark Buchanan. He's a Canadian pastor. And several people just mentioned it in different places, and I'll recommend it really highly. And just hearing the title of the book like made my blood pressure go down a bit. And so I just thought, you know, I've never thought about Sabbath, really. I need to give this some thought. Before I start, I just want to really quickly, I used kind of four main sources for this talk, and I just thought I'd go ahead and throw them up here really quickly before I start. The first is this book, Sabbath of Resistance by Walter Brueggemann. He's a professor at Columbia Seminary in Atlanta. This is a relatively new book. I think it just came out this past year. The book, The Sabbath by Abraham Joshua Heschel. He's a fairly well-known rabbi, Jewish rabbi. And then Mark Buchanan's The Rest of God. And then Keeping the Sabbath Holy by Marva Dawn. I'm sure there are many, not I'm sure, I know, there are many other books on Sabbath. There's a lot of good stuff out there on rest. These are just the ones that I had time to get through and worked from. And I would recommend all four of them. I find them all really, really helpful. So if this is a topic that you're interested in pursuing on your own, I think any of these would be great things to look at. But anyway, I never have had any real practice of Sabbath in my life. And I still don't. I told the workers at the very beginning of term, I was like, guys, I have to do this lecture in like a month. So I need to figure out Sabbath and then I need to practice it before February 3rd so that I have something. So this just like clues you in a little bit on like what the fan is doing. That hasn't happened. I'm just telling you. So yeah. And I struggle a lot for those of us who work here at LaBrie. When we're in term at LaBrie, the workers are on 6 days and we're off one day. And I struggle to know what to do with that, because when I have one day off, I'm like, I think I could do this if I had a whole weekend, but having one day off a week, I've just been challenged to figure out how to just get stuff done, just run errands and get life things done and spend time with friends and also have some sort of Sabbath. So I'm working on that. Reading and preparing for this lecture is really just the beginning of my journey towards Sabbath. I hope it's the beginning of a long journey, but I'm not quite there yet. And so I don't have a lot of firsthand experience to share with you, but I know some of you in this room do, and I've gotten some input from other people, and I'd really love for us to talk about that after we're done. I'd love to get ideas and just talk about what this looks like in real time, because I think it's a challenge for many of us. I think most Christians in America, maybe even most Americans, generally slow down on Sundays, unless you have a job where you really have to work on Sundays. But aside from attending church services and maybe sharing a meal with family or friends, most Christians that I know, and I know a lot, don't really celebrate the Sabbath in an intentional way. I realized as I started thinking about this topic that I know a lot of Christians, and I wasn't personally aware of anything that any of them did to specifically practice Sabbath. So I took an unofficial poll of some folks, about 20 friends, a few pastors from my church even. And I think for many people, a Sabbath Sunday is a good excuse to take a nap. Not that you need an excuse to take a nap, but it's a good excuse to take a weekly nap. And then it's kind of a like, oh, well, we order pizza so we don't have to cook and we watch the Patriots game on Sunday. And again, those are good things to do. Taking naps, ordering pizza, watching football, those are good things to do. But I think if that's our whole picture of what Sabbath is, we're selling ourselves short, and I think we're really kind of misunderstanding what God intended in this commandment. So part of this lecture for me was to figure out what Sabbath should be, really, and is it even possible to practice that in my life, where I am right now, and in our lives, where we are in our time and our culture. And I'm guessing some of you are here because you're wondering the same thing. My own associations with the Sabbath are loose. In my family growing up, we went to church on Sunday. Sometimes we went out to lunch with friends afterwards. And then in the evening, we had like hot dogs or popcorn or something for dinner so that my mom could take a break from cooking. We actually have a joke in our house that like popcorn is what you eat for dinner on Sunday nights because we did it so often. I grew up in the South, and I don't know what the laws were up here when they changed, but when I was growing up in the South, the blue light laws were still in effect, which meant that stores, restaurants, for the most part, couldn't open before noon on Sundays. That's not the case anymore. For several years, I worked in Brookline in a neighborhood in the midst of a pretty large Orthodox and Hasidic Jewish population, and I remember seeing observant Jews out walking on Saturdays, which is their Sabbath because they didn't drive. And that's sort of what I have in my head. I've spent some time in the book of Leviticus, so I am familiar with the detailed law that exists there, that the Israelites followed, especially on Sabbath. And I think a lot of Christians, maybe that's their association. It's like, oh, really observant Jews have these very strict laws about Sabbath, and it's kind of like, and so I think many of the regulations that are there to avoid work, right, or to avoid any appearance of work. And so Sabbath for me, and I think for a lot of people, has been something that seems more enmeshed in legalism than in freedom. But when I started reading and thinking about Sabbath, my attitude started to change. So first of all, just reading about it, just reading some of these books, like felt like a cool drink of water on a hot day. And so I was like, I think I'm onto something here. I'm not even practicing it, but I'm just reading about it and thinking about it. Just felt like this, like a wonderful thing. I just, so you know, I don't really enjoy preparing lectures at Labrie. I enjoy lecturing. I'm always glad that I have lectured. But the process of preparing the lecture and putting things on paper is fairly painful and torturous for me. This is maybe the first lecture I've done where I just really enjoyed, it's been torturous the past 2 days trying to get it on paper, but really enjoyed all, I'm just being honest with you, really enjoyed reading it and getting into the ideas and just engaging my imagination a little bit. Like, what could this look like? Like, this is something that really feels possible and available to me. And that just felt really exciting and life-giving in and of itself. We know that Jesus celebrated Sabbath, which kind of knocks out the argument that the Old Testament law is obsolete for New Testament Christians. We have to be careful how we think about that. But many of the teachings of Jesus do line up with the ideals of Sabbath. Do not worry. Love your neighbor as yourself. Come to me, all you who are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. In Mark 2, Jesus said, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath." I'm not going to do a particularly deep dive into Sabbath tonight, but I'm hoping we can all walk away with a greater sense of what it means that Sabbath was made for man, that it's not a harsh set of rules for us to squeeze and contort ourselves into, but that it's a gift of God for our freedom and for our flourishing. Exodus tells us that Sabbath will be a sign of the covenant between Yahweh and his people. And I was thinking about that a bit and how often we want a tangible sign of God's presence and care for us. I can't tell you how many times I've wished and prayed for that myself and how many conversations I've had with students at Labrie who just desperately want something tangible to show them that God is there and that he loves them. And right here in Exodus, we have scripture telling us that Sabbath is one of those things. It's a tangible sign of the covenant of God. And so I think that alone makes it worth looking at. To start, I want to just place the Sabbath commandments for you in their original context. So the Sabbath commandment sits in the middle of the Ten Commandments. There are actually the Ten Commandments are listed in their entirety twice, actually, both in Exodus and again in Deuteronomy. Plus, there's a million different places where little reminders are sprinkled in here and there. My experience in the church has been that most Christians know relatively little of the Old Testament compared to the New Testament and how the events and the information in the Old Testament hang together. I will confess that I really love the Old Testament. I'm not an expert or a scholar, but I really love it. And I find that it's not at all modern, but it's extremely relevant. I'm actually shocked almost every time I go into the Old Testament at how relevant and current it seems. I'm hoping I can translate some of that out for you tonight. So I'm going to just do a little bit of Old Testament context. I'm specifically going to spend a little bit of time talking about Egypt, because that's important for this. Okay, so the command for keeping Sabbath first appears in the Ten Commandments in the book of Exodus. So I'm just going to give you kind of a quick twirl through here through the Old Testament to kind of I'm giving you like Cliff Notes version of the Pentateuch, essentially. So to set the scene, at the end of Genesis, the Israelites are in Egypt, and Joseph has just died. An entire generation passes away, but the Israelites continue to prosper and multiply in Egypt. Because of their growing numbers and their prosperity, they became a threat to the new king, the new pharaoh, who wasn't familiar with Joseph. As tyrant kings often do, he chose to put masters over them and to make them slaves as a way to keep them from potentially rising up and presenting a serious challenge to the king and to the government. So as the Israelites worked, they were blessed and they continued to multiply, which made Pharaoh react even more harshly. So they worked day and night in the fields. They also worked making bricks to build storehouses for Pharaoh's wealth, which at that time was primarily in the form of grain. As his wealth increased, they made more bricks to make more storehouses, and on and on and on and on. But the more they worked, the more their numbers grew. So God was blessing them in that time, and they were continuing to grow and prosper. And then they came even more of a threat to Pharaoh, and then they were even more oppressed. You get the idea here. It's a serious cycle. Exodus 1 says this, "But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly." Okay, so this word ruthlessly, ruthless, bitter, hard labor, it was not a good scene. It's not a place we would want to be. In the next chapter of Exodus, Exodus 2, we read, "The Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them." Fast forward, right around this time, a Hebrew boy was born and was secretly taken into Pharaoh's house, and he was named Moses. I'm not going to spend any time on Moses' story, but at one point, Moses fled into exile into Midian, and one day he was out tending his flock, minding his own business, and a bush nearby him caught fire, but it didn't burn up. Curious, Moses went to look at the bush, and an angel of the Lord appeared to him and tells him that he is to go back to Egypt and to rescue God's people. Says, "So I have come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey." Okay, so you've got the picture. You've got Israelites growing, growing in numbers in Egypt, but severely oppressed by Pharaoh. They're slaves. They're working nonstop. And the cycle keeps getting more and more and more extreme. You've got God appointing Moses to say, okay, I've heard the cry of my people. I'm going to send you back in to bring them out to the promised land. So Moses returns to Egypt. God sends the plagues at this point to convince Pharaoh to let the Israelites go. And Moses and Aaron lead God's people out of Egypt. Along the way, God wipes out Pharaoh's entire army in the Red Sea, and he provides for the Israelites' physical needs by sending them manna in the desert to eat, and allows Moses to strike a rock so that they can drink. In there, too, Joseph and the Israelites defeat an attack from the Amalekites, and then they travel on to Sinai. And that's where we are, okay? So there's a super quick version of Exodus, essentially. You don't need to read it now if you haven't read it. So anyway, here we are at Sinai, okay? And this is where God gives Moses the Ten Commandments. So I want you to just keep in mind this journey that this group of people has been on for this season as we talk about the Ten Commandments here. So before I talk about the relevance of the fourth commandment, which is the commandment for Sabbath, I want to just spend a little time briefly looking at the Ten Commandments in case you don't remember them all. Here they are in my sort of shorthand. The fourth one is the one on Sabbath. So we have God says, you will have no other gods before me. Do not make idols. Do not misuse the name of the Lord. Remember the Sabbath. Honor your father and mother. Do not murder. Do not commit adultery. Do not steal. Do not give false testimony. And do not covet. So in many ways, the Ten Commandments were a direct response to the Israelites' experience in Egypt. God starts out with these commandments with this statement, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. He's placing them, he's reminding them of who he is and where they are. As Walter Brueggemann points out, everyone present at Sinai, Moses, the Israelites, and Yahweh, would have remembered the brutal enslavement in Egypt. Okay, so God's opening statement here is reminding them, you're not in Egypt anymore. We're done with that. That's over. And I am the one who freed you. Okay, so this is a really important context before we go through here. So with those words, God has essentially laid out a completely new order and a completely new way of living for the Israelites. In some ways, the commands might have struck a familiar tone with the Israelites because Pharaoh also laid out commands. And now Yahweh has done the same thing. But where Pharaoh's commands produce fear and violence, Yahweh's are prescribing rest, peace, trust, and harmony. So essentially, Walter Brueggemann really hammers on this. The Ten Commandments are a formula for community cohesion and neighborliness. He uses this word a lot. The result of this is meant to be not violence and oppression, but community and neighborliness. He also points out that the fourth commandment acts as a bridge in the middle of the Ten Commandments. So the first three commandments pertain to God, pertain to the Israelites' posture before God in relationship with God. And commandments 5 through 10 all pertain to relationship and posture before our neighbors. Okay, so the first part's about God, the last part's about our neighbors. And that Sabbath command in the middle, they hang together with that. So I've never thought about this before, but considering the commandments in order is quite significant and important. Because theoretically, under God's rule, a right worship of God and a right relationship with God, and then taking that through Sabbath, then we have a right ordering of other systems and priorities that allow for community and an environment of neighborliness not only to exist, but to be the overarching framework for our whole lives. Like Yahweh, Pharaoh insisted on total obedience, but his was for the purpose of a system of economic production in Egypt, which was this cycle of competition, anxiety, insecurity, restlessness, and violence. Does this sound familiar at all to anybody? It should, because we're there. Yeah. In many ways, we're still in Egypt. The whole time, Sarah Stone's heard me say this like a million times, but when I was reading this, I was like, we are in Egypt. We are in Egypt, people. We are still in Egypt. I like, said that to anybody who would listen. But really, what was happening in Egypt was the gods of commoditization went unchallenged. And so the people were stuck in a cycle of consumption. They were just consuming more and more and more. And the desire to consume produces a restlessness and an anxiety that you have to have more. You might not be able to get more. Where are you going to get more? How are you going to get more? And that restlessness and that anxiety produces violence for the sake of consumption. And by violence, I mean that in the broadest sense. Exploitation of resources, exploitation of cheap labor, destruction of God's creation, minimizing of time. So that's a broad word, violence. Brueggemann says, neighborliness doesn't produce, but it creates an environment of security and respect and dignity that redefines the human project. And I think that's really what God, I don't know for sure, but I think that's what God was trying to do here, is this idea of redefining the human project as the Israelites had known it up to that point. The Ten Commandments appear again later in Deuteronomy 5 in a similar version, though not identical to Exodus. So I just want to look at these quickly because I think this is really interesting and helps us understand this command. So in Exodus 20, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Okay? 3 books later, we're in Deuteronomy. Observe the Sabbath day by keeping it holy, as the Lord your God has commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your ox, your donkey, or any of your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns, so that your male and female servants may rest as you do. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt, and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God has commanded you to observe the Sabbath day. So in Exodus, I just want to talk quickly about the 2 parts here that I've bolded and put in italics. In the Exodus version, which is the version that came down at Sinai, the language harkens back to the creative language of Genesis. In 6 days, the Lord created, but on the seventh day, he rested. So this is really an invitation, in a way, to God's people to remember that we belong to God and were made to be like God. Mark Buchanan says that the Exodus command plays on a hidden irony that we mimic God in order to remember that we're not God. Okay, so this is, again, helping the Israelites reframe who they are and where they are. They are not God, but they were made by God in his image. And this they would have known that story. They would have known that language. And it reminds me of them. Deuteronomy, however, the language is a reminder not of Eden, but of Egypt. Remember that you were slaves in Egypt and that the Lord your God brought you out of there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. So this would have been a reminder of the Israelites' bondage and their lives when they had no choice about work or rest, that they were enslaved to someone else's selfish ambition in a cycle that they themselves had no power to get out of. By the time we get to Deuteronomy, so here they're at Sinai, they've not been out of Egypt for long. By the time they get to Deuteronomy, they are about to walk into the promised land. They've done their 40 years in the desert, they've done all their wandering, and they are on the cusp of entering the promised land. And essentially, most of the book of Deuteronomy is Moses giving a very long speech reminding the Israelites of where they've been, what God has done for them, and what he has instructed them. I sort of picture it as being like a parent who's like sending their kid, I don't know, off to a sleepover for the first time. It's like, okay, remember, you say please and you thank you. And thank you. You don't, you know, they like wash your hands when you go to the bathroom. Don't leave your shoes in the middle of the floor. Like all these things that parents hammer into their kids when they're at home, right? And then what does it look like when they're stepping out, when they're stepping out into the next thing? That's kind of how I imagine Deuteronomy. Because Moses is really kind of recounting for them everything that they've been through and wants them to remember. And this here is a reminder of what God did to set his people free. So he went to really extreme measures. If you're not familiar with the plagues, or you haven't read that in a while, go back and take a look at it. It's like a horror movie. I mean, it's like reading something out of a horror movie. The locust, the blood, death of the firstborn. It's serious. God did a lot to get the Israelites out of slavery. Drowning the army in the Red Sea, there's a lot. It seems crazy that the Israelites would ever be nostalgic for Egypt, but we know that they were. They were. Just weeks after Moses had led them out is when they were griping about having to eat manna in the desert. And they were dreaming of rich foods in Egypt. There's a songwriter that I like named Sarah Groves. And she has a song called Painting Pictures of Egypt, where she uses this whole thing kind of as a metaphor of being in between places in our lives where we would rather just go back to where we were than go forward to what's unknown. This is just part of it. But this is just one verse in the course, which says, it's not about losing faith. It's not about trust. It's all about comfortable when you move so much. The place I wasn't perfect, but I had found a way to live. It wasn't milk or honey, but neither is this. I've been painting pictures of Egypt, leaving out what it lacked. The future seems so hard, and I want to go back. But the places that used to fit me cannot hold the things I've learned. Those roads were closed off to me while my back was turned. And, you know, what she's talking about here is what they were living at the time. I mean, this is a modern song. She's not writing specifically about the Israelites. But I can relate to this, you know, this idea of like something that was just so bad. And then what God gave them was not what they were expecting. It didn't look like what they wanted. And it's easy to become nostalgic for something that was, and nostalgic for something that wasn't even what was, right? Painting pictures of Egypt, leaving out what it lacked. It's like they could remember the meat, but they somehow didn't remember, you know, the torture and the labor and the ruthlessness. But that is where we find them in Deuteronomy. Mark Buchanan describes the logic of the Sabbath command in Deuteronomy this way, which I think is helpful. Essentially, he says, don't revive what God has removed. So it's sort of the opposite in a way of the marriage command. So in the marriage command, when we say we ought not pull asunder what God has joined, he's essentially saying here, we are not to rejoin what God has pulled asunder. And this is really interesting to me to think about, you know, are there things that God has saved us from or has separated us from, either collectively as a community or as individuals, that we keep turning back to, that we keep trying to reunite with or grab? And this idea that can be just as dangerous as pulling asunder, that something that God has joined is I don't know, I just haven't thought about it in that way before. And as humans, we tend to gravitate to what we know, but God is offering something radically different here, radically different than what they've known. This is another quote from Mark Buchanan that it's a longer one, but I think it's really great on these two, the Exodus and the Deuteronomy passages. He says, Exodus grounds Sabbath in creation. Deuteronomy grounds it in liberation. Exodus remembers Eden, Deuteronomy Egypt. In Exodus, Sabbath keeping is about imitating divine example in receiving divine blessing. In Deuteronomy, it is about taking hold of divine deliverance and observing divine command. Exodus looks up, Deuteronomy looks back. Exodus gives theological rationale for rest, and Deuteronomy historical justification for it. One evokes God's character, and the other his redemption. One calls us to holy mimicry, be like God. The other to holy defiance, never be slaves again. One reminds us that we are God's children, the work of his hands. The other reminds us that we are no one's chattel, not Pharaoh's, not Nebuchadnezzar's, not Xerxes, not Beelzebub's. The one is invitation, the other is warning. And I think that's really powerful and really helpful to look at both sides of this command. And I especially love the part when he says that, that Exodus gives us a theological rationale for rest and Deuteronomy is a historical justification for it, right? So we think about Eden before the fall and the ideal of what God wanted for his people. And then we think about the reality of the fall and the very broken world that we live in, and what God has done. We can extrapolate this out to Jesus, what God has done to rescue us from that, both of which equally strong justification for Sabbath and the need for Sabbath. So if Sabbath is both an invitation and a warning, then I want to look at what that means for us now as modern day New Testament Christians. Again, I think there's some people that would say, we don't need to worry about this. Jesus came to fulfill the law, and the laws that are written in the Old Testament don't really apply to us anymore. And many of us live that way, especially in regards to Sabbath. One of my colleagues at the English Library named Marsh Moyle has done a lot of really helpful work, on the Ten Commandments. And one of the things that he talks about and works through with students sometimes is this idea of, like, just imagine, like, really engage your imagination as to what our world would be like if we actually followed the Ten Commandments. And it's a really interesting exercise to go through. I mean, just you go to Do Not Steal and you think, well, we wouldn't need all that encryption. We wouldn't need keys. The metal that's been taken out of the earth to make keys wouldn't have been taken because we don't need... I mean, you know, those are small things, but if you really kind of let yourself go down that road, it's really interesting and fascinating, and it also makes you realize how very, 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 very far we are from even coming close to taking these commandments seriously. But I do want to... you recognize the fact that we are living, we are New Testament Christians. Jesus has come to fulfill the law. And so we should not feel a pressure or a necessity to obey the law or to celebrate Sabbath the way that the Israelites did then, or even the way that our Jewish friends and peers do now. Jesus came to fulfill the law, not to abolish it. And so because of him, the Ten Commandments are no longer just about what we do, but what's in our hearts. We know that Jesus celebrated the Sabbath, though he did not follow it to the letter of the law, the way other religious leaders of his day did. He was often getting caught and tripped up and tricked by the religious leaders in this way. He often broke the law on Sabbath. But as far as we know, as far as what the Gospels give us, the gospel accounts give us of Jesus breaking the law on Sabbath. He only did that in ways that he was trying to move people toward life. When he broke the Sabbath laws, he did it typically to feed, to heal, to rescue. So movements toward liberation, which are very, very much in line with, in line with what we have here. And I think that's a really good trail marker for us as we consider what Sabbath should look like in our lives. What does it look like to move more closely towards life and towards liberation, the life and the liberation that, that God offers us through Jesus? I want to just really briefly lay out three areas of life where I think an intentional practice could be especially transformative in our lives, in our culture, and would be also particularly countercultural right now in the way we live. The first is the area of work. So this is what we most often think about when we think about Sabbath. Oh, you don't work. You stop working. And we live in a time in a culture where work and achievement and success are all gods in their own right. And this goes for Christians and people within the church as much as it does outside. I thought this was interesting in light of the Super Bowl coming up this weekend. In case you haven't heard, the Patriots are playing Falcons Sunday night. I watched a video recently that somebody sent me about the career of the Patriots quarterback, Tom Brady. I don't know why they sent it to me. I could care less about the NFL, but whatever. I watched it because I was trying to not work on this lecture. It was like, oh, something that I can do that's not this. So I watched it, all like 9 minutes of it or whatever. So Tom Brady has been to the Super Bowl and won the Super Bowl many times. I don't know how many times. Somebody in this room might know, but a lot. Four times. Okay. This will be his fifth if he wins. Okay. There we go. So Tom Brady has four Super Bowl rings, okay? And at the very, like, is this whole thing of, like, when he was a high school football player and then when he was at Michigan and this whole thing, all these interviews with people. The very, very, very last clip at the end of this, like, nine-minute-long video is just, it's like a voiceover of an interview. And someone, the interviewer, whoever it is, asks him, I don't remember how they phrased the question, but they essentially asked him which Super Bowl ring, so which of those four rings, has been the most special to him or the most important to him or the most significant one. And his response was the next one. That the ring that means the most to him, that's most significant, is the next one. It's the one he hasn't won yet. And I just thought, wow, okay. But that's really saying something, you know? And this idea of, like, again, I'm going to take you back to Egypt. We're consuming and we're achieving. We take what we have and it's not enough. So we have anxiety and we have stress because we need more and we need the next thing. Like, we're living in Egypt. This isn't the distant past. This is very much, these cycles are very much alive and well, and certainly in American culture. But in the West. And I just thought that that was just such a good description of our cultural attitudes about work and achievement. As Walter Brueggemann calls it, the culture of now. His book is called Sabbath is Resistance. So resisting the culture of now. Which is like more and better and bigger and faster. Very much like Egypt. But the thing about Sabbath is that it stops this obsession with work and its achievement in its tracks. So for 6 days we labor, but for a full 24 hours we stop. Full stop is what this is calling for. And it's essentially God, like, prying our hands, my hands, I won't speak for you, prying my hands off the steering wheel and forcing us to remember who is actually God. Who is actually in control and driving the train? It's not me. But most of us live almost all the time as if we are. It's this idea of practical atheism, right? That we're Christians and we say we believe things, but, like, functionally we live out of a different place. We live out of a place where we think of ourselves as God, even though we would never say that out loud. And we're not necessarily consciously thinking about that, but so many of us live that way. And Sabbath is really just putting a full-on stop to that, that idea. Brueggemann says, multitasking is the drive to be more than we are, to control more than we actually do, to extend our power and our effectiveness. Such practice yields a divided self with full attention given to nothing. Probably part of the reason that I feel like I only get about 20% done in a day of what I want to do is because I'm like attempting to multitask and so I just don't get anything done. Like my attention is so scattered that I can't really focus and get anything done well. But Sabbath is a space that invites us to just step out of that cycle, to once a week step out of that cycle. It protects both the space and the property of our neighbors from acquisitive, covetous practices. So again, going back to Brueggemann's idea of neighborliness, having to stop and press the pause button and put ourselves in the right place and put God in the right place is also a protection of our neighbors, you know, and it stops this culture of coveting. And even in extreme busyness, like we don't really get a pass for extreme busyness. Exodus 34 says, even during the plowing season and the harvest, you must rest. So there's no loop. Like, you're not that, you're not so important. Your thing is not so important. And I say this to you as someone who 5 days ago on Sunday, we had, I typically go to church in the afternoon and we had a Libri event on the North Shore. So I knew I wasn't going to go to church then. So I was going to go to church in the morning. No, I didn't go to church because I had to work on this lecture. And again, whatever, it is what it is. But I mean, you know, how easy is it? I'm like, well, and you know, we don't want to get legalistic about going to church, but it's like, yeah, this is me. It's like, oh yeah, but no, I'm lecturing this week. I really, you know, like this is not, it's not that, like, I hope this means something to you. I'm not like totally changing the world here, but that mindset, I mean, maybe I don't know, but the Holy Spirit will do its thing, but you know what I mean? I mean, you know what I mean? I'm assuming a lot of you can relate to me on this, and that we can make ourselves and our work and our tasks so important, and they are important. So I don't want to say that they're not. They are important. But God really doesn't give us a pass on this. If even during the plowing season and the harvest, the farmer takes the Sabbath. And the point of Sabbath is not just to take a break from work in order to store up more energy so then we can work harder the next week and produce more. I think this is a common thing. But I love this, that work itself is a good gift from God that was given to us in the garden. And we're the ones that have turned labor into toil. So work in its original state was a gift. And Sabbath is a way to offer that back to God and for him to restore the goodness that is there in our work. Abraham Heschel says, the Sabbath as a day of abstaining from work is not a depreciation, but an affirmation of labor, a divine exaltation of its dignity. And I love that idea, right? That and how many of us feel like, oh, work, oh, I got to go work, oh, I have so much work to do. You know, some people have a really wonderful attitude and relationship around the work that they do, but many people don't. And I love this idea of Sabbath not being like, okay, you can take a break, but you better like hustle double time when you're back at it again. That's not what it's about. It's about really redeeming work. And by putting work in its right place, it's restoring dignity to the work that we do, because it's a reminder that that work is not something that we're enslaved to, but it's a gift that God's given us and that we can step away from it as we step towards it as well. The second area that I just want to touch on is rest. These are all tied together, of course. It's hard to parse some of the stuff out, but again, we live in a time where most adults and some kids, certainly teenagers, don't get enough sleep. There are articles published all the time on the amount and quality of sleep that we get being linked to health issues. I had a physical this morning, and one of the questions my doctor asked me was like, do you get enough sleep? How much sleep do you get? You know, it impacts our physical health in a significant way. And because we're so tied into the cycles of work and multitasking and achievement and consumerism, we can't rest. We've just gone right back to the anxiety of Egypt. And for many of us, we just go nonstop until our bodies just won't do it anymore. That's one of the beautiful things about sleep. We can't push it off forever. We really do have to stop and sleep. But Sabbath practice isn't just about sleeping, but it's about rest. Sleep is a way that we rest, but that's not the only way to rest. And this is a place that I really struggle personally. When we hear about rest time, it usually has to do with kids. Most of the kids that I know who've outgrown their naps, taking an afternoon nap, have a rest time in place of that. So they don't have to sleep, but they have some quiet downtime in their room where they play or they read, and that's rest time. And I think one of the hardest things for me as an adult has been to figure out what rest means beyond actually sleeping. I think many of us struggle with rest because of the anxiety and just the weight of life that we carry around constantly. The idea of true rest just feels like a pipe dream. It does to me. And I think we have this idea that if we were like truly to clock out that and let our guard down, that just like mass destruction would come from that, right? That just chaos would erupt, the chaos in the world or in our homes or in our hearts. But the point of Sabbath and all of the commandments, remember, is to reorient us with what's actually true. So many of the ways that we operate is just a distorted view of reality. We're not operating out of a place of what's actually true. And what's actually true is that God is on the throne and not us. And because of that, we can rest more deeply. The well-being of our world and our communities don't ultimately rest on our very weak and insufficient shoulders. I'm sure many of you have as well. I've especially felt this in the last year, in the last 6 months, in the last 2 weeks, with everything that's going on in our country right now politically in this like 24/7 news cycle. Yeah. I mean, it is rough. But I find myself at the end of the day, I'm like, I don't want to turn it off because what if something else happens? Well, I mean, what am I going to do? I mean, the most effective thing for me to do in that moment is to pray, is actually turn it off and to pray to the one who can actually do something about it, to the one who is actually on the throne. But I think all of us are kind of, just because of social media and because of our news cycle, you know, suffering sort of even more. I'm like, oh, my grandparents who just turned on the radio once or twice a day and turned it off. You know, I mean, it's just a barrage. And I think we have to be really careful about how we expose ourselves to that. But anyway, Sabbath reminds us in tangible ways of what the ultimate truths are, that God is real, he is powerful, and that he loves us. And that he is the source of all that we have. Brueggemann says this, Sabbath is not simply the pause that refreshes. It is the pause that transforms. Whereas Israelites are always tempted to acquisitiveness, Sabbath is an invitation to receptivity, an acknowledgement that what is needed is given and need not be seized. And Sabbath is a great equalizer. The hierarchies we create for achievement, I'll just put this back really quick. The hierarchies we create around achievement and acquiring are totally dismantled in the Sabbath. All who are at rest, those who consume and those who produce. And I love that about this. So it's not just you who will honor the Sabbath, but your son, your daughter, your male and female servants, your ox, your donkey, your animals, the foreigners in your land, everyone rests. Everyone rests. And it's amazing equality that comes out of that. And it's, I think, a beautiful picture of the equality that we have in God's kingdom and in his eyes. Our economy creates the haves and the have-nots. But in Sabbath, we can remember that we're all equal before God in worth and value and access and rest, because God will provide and we don't have to continually grasp at things. To be able to really experience Sabbath means being dependent on complete confidence and trust that God is both good and he is sovereign. But Sabbath puts this belief to the test, because we if we don't believe it, if we don't believe he's really good and sovereign, then we can't rest. Then it does really depend on us. Here's another quote from Mark Buchanan. If God works all things together for good for those who love him and are called to his purposes, you can relax. If he doesn't, start worrying. If God can take any mess, any mishap, any wastage, any wreckage, any anything, and choreograph beauty and meaning from it, then you can take a day off. If he can't, get busy. Either God's always at work, watching the city, building the house, or you need to try harder. And I think Psalm 23 also paints a lovely picture of this. This has been coming up in a lot of our discussions at Libri the last week or two. But there's this picture in Psalm 23 that the psalmist gives us of God as a shepherd leading us to lie down in green pastures beside still waters, all the while restoring our souls. This is a picture of rest with God. And it's not a permanent place to live. Okay, if we're active and if we're participating in the work of the world that God has called us to participate in, we can't always be at rest beside still waters. But Sabbath offers us this space set aside to rest from our labors and for God to fill us while he continues his work in the world. My friend Louise, I didn't know she was actually going to be here when I put this in, so I feel like I should let her speak for herself. But my friend Louise, who also works in ministry, told me recently that this concept was a wake-up call for her and a key to helping her sleep in the context of Sabbath because of the idea that while she slept, God was still at work in the world was an exciting one to her. It was an idea of safety, that God is still at work. God is the one watching the city. But it also made her more eager than to wake up and to participate in what was already going on, the ongoing work of God, and not, you know, that saves us from feeling like all the work to be done is just us. It's on our shoulders. It's this idea of being able to step into the work that God already has going on, that he is doing even while we sleep. And the last area is time, kind of area of significant transformation here. In his book, The Sabbath, Abraham Heschel writes about Sabbath being a palace in time. So this very kind of three-dimensional, four-dimensional idea of a place to inhabit. And this type of imagery appears a lot in the literature on Sabbath. But it can be a hard thing, I think, to get our minds around. A helpful distinction for me is to think about Chronos time and Kairos time. Some of you may be familiar with those ideas. But Chronos being sequential or chronological time, so the time that we measure by watches and schedules and our day planners or calendars. And then Kairos time, by contrast, signaling more of a space within time, where something significant happens. So Chronos would be more quantitative, while Kairos would be qualitative. An observance of Sabbath is concerned with Kairos time. Being able to step out of Chronos time, we are more able to enter in to God's eternal time. It's a sense of eternal time. Last week, I had a day off, my day off at Libri, and I had a million things that I was going to do, but I decided to just stay home, which is really rare for me on a day off, but I had been traveling, I had been sick, and I just feel like I needed to stop. And it wasn't really a proper Sabbath, but I didn't set an alarm in the morning, and I never put my watch on. And not having to do anything or be anywhere by a particular time was such a gift, and the day did take on a different kind of dimension, where I was able to be more fully present to what was in front of me without being distracted by the, like, what's next? Do I have time? You know, am I late? That type of thing. And which for most of us kind of plagues our days most of the time. Heschel has a lovely way of thinking about Sabbath in terms of time. He describes the day itself as a living presence. And this idea that we should feel as if a welcomed guest has come to stay. And so in this way, Sabbath is much more of an embracing than a giving up or something restrictive. It's an invitation into a space in our earthly lives that edges us closer to heaven, to our this idea of our eternal rest with God, which is certainly a dimension of time that we just have no concept for here in the Kronos world. I have a friend who used to write a blog for Pathos, and it was called Thin Places. And she used that term kind of to describe the places in life where heaven and earth, or the now and the not yet, come very, very, very close together. And Sabbath is a thin place, I think, when you use that term, this idea of kind of edging us closer to eternity and that idea of time with God. Another aspect I just want to mention briefly in conjunction with time is play. This is something children are so good at and adults aren't so much. Some adults are, but I think play is a really important component of Sabbath because it not only provides a space for us to delight in God's creation and our full humanity, but because when we're playing, we easily, often without noticing it, step into Kairos time, right? We often lose track of time when we're playing. I did a lecture on play here at Liberty a couple years ago, and I dug up a quote that I loved from, I didn't pull the source. It's from Peter Berger, who's a sociologist at BU. But he says, "When one is playing, one is on a different time, no longer measured by the standard units of a larger society, but rather by the peculiar ones of the game in question. In the serious world, it may be 11 a.m. on such and such a day, month, and year. But in the universe in which one is playing, it may be the third round, the fourth act, the allegro movement, or the second kiss. In playing, one steps out of one time and into another." And so by this definition, I think play definitely has its place in Sabbath and is a really important key to helping us escape the demands of the Kronos time and into the freedom of Kairos time. Okay, lastly, I want to just ask this question. How do we do this? How do we do Sabbath? So I want to offer up a couple of ideas, and I'm really hoping we can take this into discussion because I would love people's feedback and other things on this. I think the biblical framework and the theoretical ideas around Sabbath are extremely important for having a right understanding of it. But we do have to think about how we do this now in our day and time. Unlike our Jewish counterparts, we do not have a long history or a good community memory of how to do this well or how to do this together. This has been the biggest struggle for me, I think, in looking at the challenges of my particular situation and my schedule and my life is what's realistic to expect and, like, where do I even start? And in my reading, I found two models that resonated with me, and I found them both, I think, because, you know, I haven't tried this yet, but I think realistic and doable. And the first is simple, and the second is even simpler. So hopefully you'll agree. So the first is from Marva Dawn, from her book Keeping the Sabbath Holy. And this is the framework she uses for the whole book, actually. So she offers these four kind of categories, actions. Kind of hate to use that word action for Sabbath, but for Sabbath. And they are ceasing, resting, embracing, and celebrating. So just really briefly, ceasing is this idea to stop. Stop. Stop working. Stop striving. Stop worrying. Stop cleaning and tidying. Stop the oughts. I ought to do this. I should. Stop. Resting, again, goes back to this idea that you are no longer a slave. God has set us free from Egypt. And to rest, we allow God to be God and to give up the worrying and the watching. So this is where the command here is to sleep, to rest, to be still, to be quiet, to disconnect from making in order to be able to receive. Embracing is I think of the first two as ceasing and resting as a bit of a letting go, and embracing and feasting being a taking in. But what would it look like to embrace something on Sabbath? That could be worship, that could be prayer, that could be friends, that could be creativity, hobbies, slowing down, hospitality, giving. And then the last one is feasting. Feasting obviously having to do with food, but also what else could we feast on? We could feast on beauty. We could feast on community, on time. Marva Dawn says, we don't need to wait until suffering is over to celebrate. I think sometimes when we're in a difficult season of life, feasting or celebrating, the festival idea that appears in Scripture can feel at odds with suffering and with darkness. But the reason, part of the reason we celebrate Sabbath, part of the reason that Christians celebrate the Sabbath on Sunday and not Saturday is because that is the day of resurrection. And so even when we're suffering, it is appropriate to acknowledge the resurrection. And that takes us back to God being the one on the throne. Just a note on feasting. Ceasing, resting. Celebrating, sorry. Celebrating, feasting, same thing. Sorry, I mixed it up here. You guys are like, what are you talking about? Celebrating, feasting, there you go. Mark Buchanan made a great point in his book, which I've been thinking about a lot. If you think about Sabbath being a time for feasting, but we live in a time now where we feast all the time, right? And so what does it look like to feast? And he, in his practice of Sabbath and moving towards this, is he actually kind of took a step back and simplified that he was the way he was eating during the week so that he could feast on the Sabbath, because he was sort of at a point where it's like, well, I eat pancakes whenever I want to eat pancakes. I eat ice cream whenever I feel like it. But anyway, that was just an interesting thought for me. The second model is from Mark Buchanan from his book, The Rest of God, and it's just a pared down version. And so he gives these things that he describes as the golden rule of Sabbath, which is the first is cease from that which is necessary, or stop doing what you ought to do. And the second is embrace that which gives life, which is just in many ways a shorter version of Marva Dawn here. So essentially we need to know what to avoid, and we need to know what to pursue. I've talked to, as I said, a lot of people about Sabbath, and I've asked how they've approached it. I emailed some friends. I've talked to some students here. And I want to just, I didn't even do a slide for them. It's kind of a laundry list, but I just want to toss out some practical ideas of ways that we might be able to incorporate Sabbath into our life. They're not really ordered in any particular way, but as I go through them, you can kind of think about where they might fit in these places for you. And I just want to put this out as a jumping off point, and then we can talk about other things later. But the first being that Sabbath obviously doesn't always have to be on a Sunday. If Sunday doesn't work for you for whatever reason, your pastor, Sunday is not a Sabbath for your pastor, in case you didn't know that. I mean, there's some people who do work on Sunday. They have to work on Sunday, and they have to take Sabbath a different day, and that's okay. I think it's helpful to have some kind of regular tradition to help mark the start of Sabbath. So whether you're really trying to do a 24-hour something starting in the evening and going through the next day, or whether it's just within morning, tonight, a day, whether that means lighting candles, that's something that's part of the Jewish practice of Sabbath, is that's the first thing. At the sun sets and they light the candles, and that is the start of Sabbath. Whether it's playing a piece of music or having some activity that you do every week to usher it in. Back to this do not work, I think just a place to start with do not work is do not work at your paid job. Whatever your paid job is, whatever you do during the week, don't do that. Turn off notifications on your phone. Don't check work email or work social media accounts. And I think it's also helpful to think about what's the opposite of your job. Because when you think about the Jewish practice of Sabbath, it's like, well, if I write a letter, is that work? Like, you know, it gets dicey, as we know. But I think it's helpful to think about what the what the opposite of your job is. So for me, I cook a lot for my job. I cook a lot. I host people in my home. I serve meals. That's not really what I want to do necessarily on Sabbath, because I do it so much during the week and it is something for work. But if you're somebody who sits at a desk all day, cooking a meal and having friends over could be a really wonderful life-giving thing for you. Again, we chop a lot of wood around here at Liberty. I don't. Other people do. But I haven't even asked him this, but chopping wood might not be something that Ben would want to do on the Sabbath. I don't know. Maybe you would. But Ben does a lot of wood chopping in dealing with wood during the week. But if you're somebody, again, who has a more sedentary job or you're inside all day, going outside and chopping wood might be a wonderful thing to do on Sabbath, to use your body and be outside and be in nature. So I think it's helpful to think about, like, what, not only what is your specific job, but sort of what are the limits put around you because of your work, and what would the opposite of that be, versus figuring out, is this work, you know, like picking it apart. Don't set an alarm. Sleep in the morning if you can do that. I think anything you can do to separate from Chronos time and step into Kairos time. A friend who attends my church, she has two young kids, and her family goes to this afternoon service at my church, and she said that they really love doing the afternoon service because Sunday is the only day of the week that they don't have to be up and dressed and out of the house by a certain time. And so they, she said, her kids are always in their pajamas till 3 o'clock when it's time for them to get dressed and go to church, and they make a big breakfast. And she's like, we just like play puzzles and hang out at home. And that's a really restful thing. And it's something they can't do the rest of the week. I think spending time with friends is always a good thing. Celebrating Sabbath in community. You don't have to just sequester yourself away, and just be quiet and still in that way. Spending time with friends and community is a great thing. Getting out into creation. So whether that means a picnic, eating or reading a book in the backyard, going for a hike, going to the beach. So being in God's creation. I think taking a break from social media and technology altogether, if you can. Reading fiction or poetry. Worship and prayer, obviously. Exercise. I think exercise is an interesting one. One of the pastors at my church told me that she and her husband, who both work at the church, they do their Sabbath on Monday, and she said they always like to exercise because it's not something they can do together in the week. And another pastor at my church told me on Sundays she doesn't exercise, wear her Fitbit, or weigh herself, which I thought was interesting. So again, like, I think it's helpful to just think about, like, where are you in response to those things? If you're somebody who's religiously at the gym at 6 o'clock every morning, maybe you don't exercise on Sunday. If you're somebody who rarely is able to get out and take a walk in the fresh air, then that's a great thing to do. Again, eating special foods, you know, having ice cream for dessert, having pizza, having pancakes for breakfast, this feasting idea, whatever that means. Cooking ahead of time, if you don't want to have to cook on the Sabbath. I think not doing chores. Let the laundry go. Let the dishes go. You can do them on Monday just as easily as you can do them on Sunday. I have one friend who said she always does laundry on Sunday, and she's like, I can't even imagine not doing laundry on Sunday. That's so stressful to me to think about not doing laundry on Sunday because the whole week would fall apart. You know, and it's like, well, would it? You know, it probably means that you need to do the laundry on Friday and Saturday, right? So there's definitely rejiggering that has to happen here. This isn't, it just doesn't happen. But I think these things that we hold on to where it's like, I can't go to bed with dishes in the sink. Like, what's that about? You know, I think those are things, and again, it's not a bad thing, but I think those things that we are holding on to really tightly, like, I can't go to bed if there's dirty dishes in the sink. You know, there's a sense of, like, Sabbath gives us some space to, like, what's underneath that? What feels like it'll fall apart if there are dishes left in the sink or if the laundry isn't all finished by Sunday night? Do something creative, color, draw, paint, write, sculpt, chisel, carve. Call somebody on the phone that you don't get to talk to very much that you love. Take a nap. One thing, where's Melissa? Our helper, Melissa, I was talking to her about this, and she said that someone had recommended to her that, or was talking to her, not even so much specifically about Sabbath, but the idea of weekends and resting on weekends, and how most people who have weekends, your weekend doesn't, you don't really sort of come down off the work week till like sometime mid-morning on Saturday. And then like midday on Sunday, you're revving back up again. And so you think like, oh, we've got like 2.5 days off, but it's not really 2.5 days of rest. And so this idea of like planning something fun to look forward to at the end of the day on Sunday, so that you can really, if Sunday is the day that you're using, or whatever day you're doing Sabbath, to be able to really relish that full day and not feel like, well, it's 6 o'clock, I got to start packing lunches for tomorrow and checking email at work so I'm not overwhelmed tomorrow morning. And those types of things, those kind of Sunday night blues that a lot of people have. I liked that idea of having something celebratory at the end of the day. So anyway, those are just some ideas we can talk about more. But just wrapping up, in several places in my reading, I read this kind of this saying or this idea in Jewish culture, which is that the Jews kept Sabbath, but the Sabbath kept the Jews. Meaning in trying and difficult times, the most recent being the Nazi occupation in Europe, World War II, the Jews' faithful keeping of Sabbath command in the good times carried them through the dark times with a very, very tangible knowledge of God's love for them and God's presence and his faithfulness to them. And that resonates with me. I was like, ooh, yeah, if I had this time in the week, every week, to really be connected to God in that way and myself in that way too, I think the ripple effects of that would be significant, especially when the seasons tilt. Isaiah 58 says this, "If you keep your feet from breaking the Sabbath and from doing as you please on my holy day, if you call the Sabbath a delight and the Lord's holy day honorable, and if you honor it by not going your own way and not doing as you please or speaking idle words, then you will find your joy in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the heights of the land and to feast on the inheritance of your father Jacob." We have a student with us this term who has developed a regular habit of Sabbath practice in the last couple of years, and it was really helpful to talk with her. And one of the things that she told me about her Sabbath practice is that she struggled for a long time to really, really know that God loves her. And I certainly relate to that, and I'm sure many of us can. And she said that one of the things that Sabbath has given her is that through Sabbath, she knows that God loves her. And that goes back to that promise in Exodus that God has given us a sign and a command of his covenant with us and his faithfulness to us, and it is Sabbath. And that is my prayer for myself. That's my prayer for all of you, and I hope for you as well. So I'm going to stop there. If you have not been to Labrie before, we always open it up after lectures. Feel free to ask questions. Feel free to disagree with me. We can have a discussion. I would love to, not to micromanage the conversation, but I would love if people have specific experiences in regards to Sabbath that they'd like to share. I would love that. If you need to go, please feel free to go. Don't feel like you have to stay till the bitter end. We know it's late and it's a long week. So if you need to go, please do that. But if you'd like to stay, we'd love to chat. So open it up.
Hi. So I was reading something on fasting a couple of weeks ago, and it was really like a practical guide to fasting and ending a fast. And it didn't have anything to do with biblical fast per se.
Yeah.
But the author or the instructor was talking about, if you're doing this type of fast, then if you're going to exercise, make sure that it's, slow and steady and not more than a couple of miles. And I was like, my gosh, that's a Sabbath day's walk. So this really kind of piqued my interest in the topic more.
One thing I didn't talk about here, but that I wonder about too in thinking about play and thinking about exercise, is the idea of competition, of like, well, what if we played soccer in the backyard? Or it's just interesting to think about that idea of sport and competition, and even the ways we compete with ourselves, of like walking farther, running faster. Like, I wonder kind of what a right way is to think about that. I know so many people who have kids that play like town soccer and baseball and stuff, and there's like games and practices on Sundays all the time. And I don't know how you deal with that. But anyway, I wouldn't ever want to say, like, you know, it's not the right thing. You know, it's not right. I don't know. But, yeah, this idea of slow and steady versus, like, is there some sort of internal kind of competition or something we're trying to prove in that moment may not be the day to do that. I don't know.
What if that game, like, maybe it is negative thinking, but what if that game is your release and the way you relax?
No, totally.
Soccer with your buddies.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's again, one of those places that, like, I would never want to say, like, yeah, it's an okay thing to do, or no, it's not. But it's like, what's the spirit of that? What is the nature of that for you? Yeah, is that a way that you really, like, inhabit your body in a full way and feel like you're kind of living out some of your humanity in a way that God's gifting you and something you get a lot of joy out of? Yeah, absolutely. No, and I think that, again, I think it just depends on who we are and where we're standing, as with so many of these things. Yeah, yeah.
You've given me so much food for thought. It's really pretty overwhelming and wonderful. But one of the things was about what we really believe about God's sovereignty. And do we trust him? Can we rest in him? If we can't, I've forgotten who the quote was.
Yeah.
But then I started thinking about whose time is it anyway that we live in? Mm. I mean, who's given us the time? Mm-hmm. And are we coveting it?
Mm-hmm.
And are we, you know, stealing it from the person? God has given it to us.
Yeah.
And then that started shifting my thinking, and I've got a lot further to go with that.
Yeah. Well, and it... Yeah, I didn't do a lot with this, but that same idea of, like, of anything that we have, how much of it is ours, right? So time, but, you know, our possessions, our property, this planet, our gifts and our abilities. I mean, I think Christians would recognize that all of those things are a gift from God. That doesn't mean we're puppets and we have no volition of how to use those things and utilize them, but I think that's part of what Sabbath, I think that part of this reorienting of, like, the things that I'm like, no, this is mine. You know, it's a stopping and saying, like, no, these things are gifts. God has given them to me to steward, whether it's a family, whether it's a house, whether it's a job, whether it's a ability to play the piano well, whatever that is. Yeah, just a reminder of where all that comes from and who that belongs to. Yeah. Other things? Yeah. Kevin?
Just something, the parallels between the two passages in Exodus and Deuteronomy, specifically the Exodus passages having to do with creation and the Deuteronomy with liberation. I think one of the things when I initially read Martin Buchanan's Rest of God that stuck out to me was him talking about enjoying the rest of God that we miss out on the other 6 days of the week. And this parallel, I think, is particularly striking, just thinking of, you know, on the sixth day, God delights, and he sets that apart, and he enjoys his creation, enjoys the way the purpose is put in it, and for mankind, for the animals, for the plants. There's a freedom in just the flourishing of their identity.
Yeah.
And then, I guess, with the Deuteronomy, the liberation, pointing towards Christ and the freedom we have, the redeemed image, and coming back around upon it. So with this idea of keeping a Sabbath, previously I kind of always thought of it, well, whatever brings me, wherever I can see God in ways that I don't allow myself to walk to see him throughout the rest of the week, or what brings me life, and how can I honor God in that? But I think particularly right now, what I was thinking about was, well, who are we really? What are the gifts or the passions or the mission that God has given to each of us individually? Mm-hmm. And how on that Sabbath observance can we rest and be liberated in that identity? So are there certain, maybe we're artists, but we haven't allowed ourselves to actually paint in a long time, and that creativity is an integral part of how God has created us, or storytellers, having people over and reading stories out loud. There's scattered thoughts, but I was just thinking of how both honoring and enjoying the rest of God we miss out on, but also the rest from ceasing from busyness, but also the resting in identity and the freedom of flourishing in that.
Yeah, definitely. I think this idea that of Sabbath not being something, this like list of rules that need to bind us in, but it's a framework for freedom to flourish. You know, I think that this idea of it being a place to encourage our flourishing is really significant and important. Yeah. Ready?
First of all, thank you so much. It was a great lecture.
Welcome. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Helen, it wasn't as short as I told you it was going to be. Helen, I was like, it's
really,
so short.
Really helpful. Tons of things to think about. I was just, when you were describing yourself in the beginning, it sounds very familiar. What John Kabat-Zinn calls hurry sickness. There's never enough time.
Yeah.
And my husband, Vic, has always been really helpful to me against the, not that I listen all the time, but I should. Yeah. But the list, you know, that I always have too long a list for what's possible. So maybe, but I just was thinking in terms, instead of in light of your practical applications, maybe consciously making a really short list for your day, way shorter than, and then at the end of the day, wow, I got one more thing done that was on my list. Thank you, God.
Yeah.
I mean, rather, because Dick is always saying, why do you have to do all those things today?
Right.
Or this sort of, I've got to do this, I've got to do, stopping to ask, what will happen? And it really, you're right. I mean, what, everything you said about, and I think the role of Sabbath in the Bible has hugely been trusting God. When, for Israel to not work 7 days a week when all their neighbors were working seven days a week, and where the pressure, the competitive pressure to, well, we won't make it economically. Well, it's actually trusting God to say no.
Yeah.
We're not running the universe. God is. And it's very interesting. Evidently, I don't know what stage this was, but under in the Soviet Union, under communism, for a while, they tried to get a longer work week by making everybody basically have one day off in 10 instead of one in 7, and including animals, and the animals started dying. So there's something really built in that we... That pattern is something that's built in.
And there's, I can't remember which book it was in, but this really lovely thing about God in sort of, especially in Genesis, and when you see, I didn't really touch on this, but in Leviticus, you see the law, you know, the Sabbath for the land too. Yeah. You know, it's like every 7 years you will not work the land. And just the idea that God having confidence and faith in his own creation, that you can rest and that, like, these things that I have set in motion will continue. You know, the land will produce, that what I have created will continue in the way that I created for it to continue, and trusting in that provision. Yeah. I was thinking, when I was doing this, that, in this way of like this list and never getting things done, I'm like just like my dad in this way. And I was just like, oh, you know. I've never really thought about this before, but I was like, my mom isn't like that at all. And I just started thinking, I was like, I don't think I have ever heard my mother say that she's busy or that she's so busy. I don't think I've ever heard her, those words come out of her mouth, like in a response to somebody, you know. She has plenty to do, but she's not, and I wonder about this sometimes. I'm like, I should have a conversation with her about this. Like, what are her expectations for the day, and what are her expectations for herself and what she can produce? Because she doesn't have the fan at all. And she doesn't, you know, she gets worried and stressed about things, but not about, like, getting stuff done and accomplishing things and getting things checked off on the list. It's interesting to think about that. Anyway, other things. Oh, hang on, I'm just going to go back here. Yeah, Tom.
Speaking of giving the land rest, tenured professors you can today sometimes get a sabbatical
year. Yeah, absolutely.
Do the books say anything about taking 1 year off in Seventh, really?
No, they didn't. I mean, you know, you see that for pastors, too. Pastors often take sabbaticals. I don't know. I don't know how the academics, you know, I'm assuming they're not using a biblical justification for it. Pastors would.
Costs are very high.
Yes, yes, they are.
Justification is research. Yeah. Right?
But
so it's not always. You're right. It's not a total year off from work, but it's there's
means,
a to do something different.
To do something different. But,
yeah.
But again, I mean, God's concept for the land, it wasn't just the land. The people obviously weren't planting or harvesting.
Right, and the animals weren't working, and
so something. Yep. I mean, that seems so far beyond anything we can imagine.
Agree.
Without planning, in my early years, I had a couple of sabbatical years due to companies failing.
It's a different kind.
I didn't stress. I did a lot of other different things, and it worked out.
Yes. One thing that I thought was interesting in Mark Buchanan's book is that he wrote that book during a sabbatical. He's a pastor on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, and he wrote the book during a sabbatical. I don't know if it was a full year or how long it was. But he talked about how several years prior to his sabbatical, they started bringing up this idea of him taking a sabbatical and whatever. And he realized that he had no actual practice of Sabbath. And he was like, if I don't have a practice of Sabbath, what the heck am I going to do with a sabbatical? Like, he was like, I wouldn't, that would be a waste. And so I think he says this, that he actually put it off intentionally, the sabbatical off a bit, to get himself into just a practice of recognizing Sabbath, a weekly Sabbath, so that he might be able to rightly appreciate the sabbatical and have the sabbatical be, which I thought was really interesting. But, Ben?
Yeah, I was just remembering a sermon I heard a long time ago on the Ten Commandments, a series of sermons, actually, and the preacher was talking about the reason for the introduction to the Ten Commandments, which we often don't read, which is, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt, the land of slavery, is a way of framing the Ten Commandments to come after it. So it's both a reminder of who God is and what he's done for you. So why in the world wouldn't you do what he says?
Yeah.
But it's also, it frames the entire Decalogue in terms of freedom. Mm-hmm. So this is I'm the God that set you free, that brought you out of the land of slavery. Here's a way of life that will ensure you remain free.
Yeah.
Free from not just physical slavery or bondage, literally, but free from other kinds of bondage.
Yeah.
And I found that so incredibly helpful.
Yes.
In that it kind of breaks the Ten Commandments free from a legalistic kind of understanding.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, it's a response to what God has already done for you.
Yeah.
So it's not do this and this and this and then maybe I'll accept you. Mm-hmm. Which is the way legalism usually functions.
Right, yeah.
It's, no, I've already given you freedom. Now you respond. Mm-hmm. This is how you live to stay free.
Yeah.
I thought it was
very... It's based on God's performance and actions and not ours. Yeah.
I have one other question. I don't know if you this is right or not, but I'm just wondering whether... I forget whether it was the Deuteronomy passage or the Exodus passage talking about how the extent to which everyone has to rest, the animals, your servants, manservants, women servants, whether there's an aspect of that that it's not just telling the Israelites, don't get so busy and driven that you enslave yourselves again, but make sure you don't become slave masters.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Don't. Yeah. You know, remember that you were slaves in Egypt. Don't become slaves, but don't become Egyptians either.
Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
Because it's forcing people to not, even if you're observing Sabbath, what if you're what if your servant isn't a Jew? I mean, a lot of non-Jews were in were in the land at the time, and yeah. Is it okay to make them work?
Right.
Like, no,
right.
Actually, it's not. Right. I found that to be...
But these are all slaves anyway, right? I mean, it's a euphemism for slave anyway, right?
Well, servant, yes.
Yeah.
Your slave a break.
Yeah. No, that's a good point, Ben, because I think the... this idea of it being something that's like leveling the playing field, this great equalizer of producers and consumers and kind of all down to the donkey and the ox, but I think that, just putting that label on it, that's a helpful way to frame it of not becoming what you were just rescued from, not becoming that yourself. Yeah. Kath?
Similar to that, I was struck, I don't think I've ever paid attention to the foreigner or the alien within the gates aspect. And, I mean, just the practice of hospitality, which you guys do so well here, but also in the pages of Scripture, we see that at the heart of Christ's ministry is hospitality, is welcoming the stranger. And so, even as these commands are being given, they're being given to wanderers. They're being given to strangers and aliens. Mm-hmm. But yet saying, but this is the type of culture, the rest that I want you to make a reality for those who are also aliens and strangers, just as you are.
Yeah.
And even now, we're strangers and aliens in a foreign land.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it?
Mm-hmm. And that Christ came to us when we were still strangers to him. No, absolutely. Sarah Stone.
When you were talking about resting by the still waters, I think you said that we cannot do that every day.
We can't stay there all the time.
We can't stay there. I'm wondering about resting in Jesus and how that relates to this. And I don't know if you've heard the phrase, Jesus is your Sabbath. You heard that? I heard that a lot back at home in our church. Like, let Jesus be your Sabbath because he did the work. Similar to what you're thinking of as not the Jesus, but the work that he has. I'm just wondering the differences between rest, like actually physically stopping and resting that one day a week, and then this mindset of resting and letting him be your son.
I don't think it's two different things. I think I don't think we're capable of letting Jesus be our Sabbath all the time. He is that. But I think the things that Sabbath in this way is calling us to is kind of what we have to do in order for Jesus to be our Sabbath, in order for God to be our Sabbath. You know what I mean? Because I think it depends a little bit on, like, when we say Jesus, this is my Sabbath, like what does that actually look like on the ground? You know? And when I think about that, I think of like, okay, if Jesus is my rest, it goes back to all these things we've been talking about, which is recognizing that, like, I am not in control. I am not God. Everything doesn't rest on my shoulders, whatever. But for me to have any sort of consistent settlement in that kind of place, I think I need to practice Sabbath. Does that make sense?
Yeah,
I don't know.
I have something Mm.
Welcome.
Yeah, thanks. Okay, so like I think that sometimes God places like intentional parallels in life to help us understand a greater picture. I think that what you might be trying to say is that in our daily lives we can rest in the fact that it is finished.
Mm-hmm.
Like we don't have to make those lists and feel that we need to check off every single little thing in order to feel accomplished or to feel worthy. And with that being said, God put into place the concept of Sabbath to help us comprehend it, to help us practice it, that in our daily lives, mm-hmm. and in our week and in our schedule, to remember that it is finished, that we can rest in that. And it's also in the timeline of the week. Mm-hmm. So it's something we can physically practice and remember.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think when we say yes to Sabbath, like, I really appreciate the statement that you said as far as, you know, the Jews kept the Sabbath. Actually, it kept them. Mm-hmm. As we dare to say yes to this, I believe we're building capacity inside of ourselves. You know, again, you use the quote of Sabbath as place. Mm-hmm. And like Psalm 23 begins with, the Lord is my shepherd. I shall not be in want, to go with your commodifying.
Yeah.
So here's my choice. Am I going to know this isness, this now of God, or am I going to be in want?
Mm-hmm.
And so every week I'm invited to practice or to, like, do you believe me, Louise?
Yeah.
And am I going to say yes?
Yeah.
And in my yes, am I going to at sometimes be feeling a real fight? Or like, how can I get away with doing what I want to do? And let's say this is Sabbath. Mm-hmm. And yet the whole time, even that is a gift to me, because I'm watching the little schemer in me who is still trying to get what she wants rather than receive it is done.
The grasping.
And so it's a very active thing, this thing of Sabbath and rest. It's a call of participation.
Yes.
And an invitation to know in our very insides.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's conquering the promised land of us.
Mm-hmm.
We've been promised to him by the Father.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's such a good point. And I think that's, like, that's something I would say to Sarah's thing too, of the, it's like, what do we say and what do we believe up here? But then how, like, God became flesh. What does that look like when we imbibe that and live that out? And I, as someone who has not had a habit or practice of practicing Sabbath, I just can imagine. And again, Louise, I loved that quote too, of like, the Jews kept the Sabbath, but the Sabbath kept them. And I just can imagine the type of transformation and just internal change and movement that's possible by having to really sit in that space, not to talk about that space or imagine the space, but to really dwell in that space with God. And where are the places that I'm still trying to take? Where are the places that I don't trust? Where am I still grasping? So I don't know, Sarah. I mean, I guess that was my response. I don't know. But I think, you know, and Jesus calls himself the Lord of the Sabbath. You know, I read that quote. But that we embody that in some way versus just something that's up here, I guess. Anything else?
Yeah, I'm just thinking, I mean, this isn't maybe a new thought, but just that every time that I feel like I've been able to practice Sabbath well, it's always very reorienting.
Reorienting?
Yeah, that's what I think is like one distinguishing feature for me. Like recently I was at an event that was, it's kind of this action-packed event, but for without going into details, it was Sabbath for me, and it hit me like how much I was reminded during that day of things that I'd forgotten, just truths about God, and I was refocused back into what is true, kind of like, you know, the Psalms. So that's often the psalmist might be disoriented, or like, God, where are you in this?
Yeah,
what happened? And it comes back to a place of understanding what the truth is, understanding that God is sovereign, or he's good, or he's whatever the psalmist was kind of forgetting about God. So I think that's another element to Sabbath too, that for myself at least it's
absolutely. I think too, it's also like I think it's also being reoriented back to ourselves too, and who we are. And there's a, Mark Buchanan has a thing, Sarah and I were talking about it the other day, because a friend had sent her this quote separate from this, where he says something about like, we need Sabbath when we don't love any, we no longer love the things we love. I mean, this idea of, and I can relate to that in a way, but I think where what you're talking about, when we can, you know, Calvin talked about to know ourselves, we have to know God, and to know God, we have to know ourselves, and it's this very connected cyclical thing. And I think there's a way when what you're talking about, when it, we're reoriented to God in new ways or in old ways that we've forgotten, then we gain a knowledge and an orientation of self as well that is more true and more right than the way the world and culture tries to, we try to orient the self in that direction, you know?
Yeah. Plus, I think what you bring that back into the other 6 days, which is...
Yes. Yeah, oh, absolutely.
It's like a lot different.
Absolutely.
You do that.
Yeah.
Whereas if you don't, I think, before you know it, the ship's like steering off like...
Totally, yeah. And in a lot of the Jewish writings, they talk about the Sabbath being... You spend the 3 days after Sabbath remembering, and then you spend the next 3 days preparing. So you're sort of always in this Sabbath mindset.
I was just thinking back to Ben's lecture about ordering of fears.
Yeah.
And then when you were talking about the difference between Chronos and Kairos, mm-hmm. it for some reason made me think of that lecture and how this seems more like it's almost like an ordering of your time or your days.
Yeah.
In the same way that there's this huge distinction between like the fear of the Lord, which I'm looking forward to part two, and three probably of that lecture series. But there's also, I think that was interesting when you were mentioning Kairos, and there's also this distinction between like God's time and eternal time, mm-hmm. and how we order our lives based on that.
Yeah.
And then sort of Chronos time is the same thing. It's sort of like this fear of God is very different than our anxiety, just like the other fears that should mm-hmm. be secondary to it.
Yeah.
It can be really nostalgic for like peanut butter and popcorn.
Right, you know, popcorn on Sunday nights, the way to do it, yeah. And I think so often when we talk about time, we talk about time as a slave master or a taskmaster. You know, people use that language to talk about time, and that's the Chronos time. It feels that way. Yeah. Melissa?
Yeah, I just think, too, like, I was thinking about manna and the provision of Sabbath and mm-hmm. how when we are obedient, when we know the need and we observe Sabbath, like, there is the provision, mm-hmm. like, that will come.
Yeah.
And, mm-hmm. And I think I was thinking about why is there resistance sometimes, even, you know, like, I love the idea of Sabbath, why is there resistance? And mm-hmm. I think the idea of grace, like, we resist mm-hmm. Sabbath because we resist mm-hmm. grace. And,
yeah.
I think that reminds me of something that struck me in the middle of the lecture is that when you made a comment about how, what are we afraid of? Are we afraid that everything is going to fall apart or come crashing mm-hmm. down if I stop? Well, I think for many people that, in a sense, that is the case because I keep busy to keep from thinking about the basic meaninglessness of my life.
Yeah.
And all the things, all my bad memories, things that I've never dealt with, psychological
totally.
Issues. Like, we keep busy, we keep a radio playing, we keep something to distract ourselves at all time. And the mm-hmm. idea of solitude or actual rest is horrifying
mm-hmm.
because you know it's all mm-hmm. right here. You know, and I've known people like this
where
they could not bear silence mm-hmm. because you get the sense of just because of what will come rushing to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a busyness is like just a constant defense
mm-hmm.
against whatever. You know, I guess it's different for everybody. But, it's one of the reasons why the idea of Sabbath or retreat or mm-hmm. solitude is just like
scary.
Some people it's a very restful idea. Other people it's just a
mm-hmm.
terrifying
mm-hmm.
idea.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Anything else? On that depressing note. Thank you.
I appreciate what you said, but something that I'm thinking about, and I love that you quoted the exit or the Isaiah passage,
mm-hmm.
because the word delight in there,
mm-hmm.
And I've done very, very minimal reading on Sabbath, but one of the guys dudes that I read was his last one, instead of celebrating, is delight. So mm-hmm. his word is delight.
Yeah.
And he talked about, like, when he very, very first started to practice Sabbath, he was a pastor in New York City, still is a pastor in New York City, was, like, crazy burnt out and, like, crazy workaholic. And when he first brushed up against this idea of Sabbath, he was like, okay, when I take my Sabbath, I'm just gonna do the same things, but I'm gonna do them with a different orientation. And mm-hmm. so, like, he told a story about washing his hands in a McDonald's bathroom. Mm-hmm. And instead of, like, okay, you know, he was like, okay, let me take time to actually feel the hot water on my hands. Mm-hmm. And I'm serious. And, like yeah. lower them up to the, like, to the wrists instead of, like, fingertips, which is what we like to do.
Yeah.
I don't know how I do it, too. But, like, I just, like, that was such a memorable image for me of, like, mm-hmm. like, he's delighting in washing his hands.
Yeah.
And so, like, I don't know, for me that was just, I just loved that that was in the in that scripture that you used, because this idea of practicing delight.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
even that hearkening back to the creation story of it is good.
Mm-hmm.
Like, God finishing and being like, this is good.
Yeah.
You know, and so, and the same thing with, like, making a meal, like, instead of me being like, all right, microwave dinner, boom.
Yeah.
But, like, wow, this is good, even if it's just oatmeal with maple syrup on top.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. Thank you. That's a lovely way to wrap it up. Thank you for joining us. Yeah. All right.